Fresh and Sustain, WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
You'd be so nice to come home to. You'd be so nice. Bye.
I'm Muiza Muntali, host of African Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
Welcome, listeners, to this hour at WPFW Washington, 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. You are listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. Last week, we had an episode entitled American Patriots Descent, Part 1. Today, we're doing the Part 2 portion of that topic. And before I go further and introduce our guests, I'd like to dedicate this show to Dory Ladner, SNCC activist, friend of WPFW, member of CORE, the NAACP Youth League in her growing up. Just an incredible, incredible woman, a friend to just about anyone she met, but she purposed herself for the full humanity of Black folk and all people. And we lost another person in this world who's become an ancestor, Faith Ringgold, artist of many, many mediums, but social activist. The art world, whether it's in the United States or across the world, will never be the same without her. She has contributed greatly to the depth of our understanding of justice and humanity. I salute both women, extend my condolences to both families, and I thank them for the privilege of talking to them on this show. Without further ado, our guest is Ralph Young. Dr. Young is professor of instruction in history at Temple University. He is the author of Descent, The History of an American Idea, and the editor of Make Art, Not War, Political Protest Posters from the 20th Century, and Descent in America, The Voices That Shape a Nation. His latest book, American Patriots, A Short History of Descent, is the basis of our conversation. The history of America includes a history of descent. Descent has played a key role in shaping this country, calling many of us to fulfill what we have claimed and written. Activists, both extraordinary and ordinary people, have called us to live up to our ideals. So we'll examine the notion of descent throughout our history. And in this episode, we'll try to focus on U.S. descent movements after World War II and onward. Well, good morning and welcome, Dr. Young. It's a pleasure to have you again.
My pleasure as well.
So if you allow me, the recap is, even from colonial times, we've had some notion of descent. And we took a survey of or we went through the landscape of history. We owe a lot to the transcendentalists, to Thoreau, Emerson, and others, emphasizing the precious importance of humanity, of the human individual, of human flourishing. We looked at figures like Emma Goldman and Joe Hill and Mother Jones and Ida Wells Barnett, adding the element of the importance of truth-telling with ferocity and with integrity. And so I hope, if I'm not overlooking anything, that we'll find ourselves soon coming out of the Depression era into World War II, and then we'll proceed onward. But first of all, let me ask you, you've made many observations and done a lot of work regarding the issue of dissent. How do you define it? What do you want us to frame our thinking around?
Well, basically, dissent, of course, is going against the grain, against what is. But really, it must coincide with the right to dissent that the framers inscribed in the Constitution. The delegates at the Constitutional Convention understood they were setting up an experiment in democracy. This democratic republican form of government that they were establishing was an experiment to see if a government of the people, thus we the people in the preamble to the Constitution, it was an experiment to see if that kind of a government would work and flourish. And the dissent they established as a right in the First Amendment was to be used in support of a government of the people. It must coincide with the natural and civil rights guaranteed in the Bill of Rights. And so if it goes against, if dissenters are protesting just for something very personal for themselves to maintain their own superiority or supremacy, and it is taking away rights from others, then that's going against the Constitution. Dissenters really are true patriots because they demand that the United States live up to its high ideals that it put down on paper. And so, and anybody who practices dissent that goes against those ideals is not really one of the American patriots that I refer to in the title.
Yes. And at initiation, all these rights were ascribed and endowed to a privileged few, namely white male slaveholders and people of means.
Yes. And of course, I always point out to my students that when Jefferson wrote all men are created equal, it meant a much smaller group of people in those days. But the history of the United States is the expansion of that phrase. And that's because dissenters are pushing the United States to live up to the ideals that are put down. And so the bulk of dissent has been in the expansion of that phrase and the expansion of rights for more and more people. But of course, we're not there yet. It's still an ongoing process. Martin Luther King once said that American democracy is an unkept promise. And it's a promise, but dissenters are pushing the country to live up to it.
I want to tip off a little bit of what I believe is going to be toward the end of our argument. But I want to ask this particular question now. In working with your book and doing research and living my life and having a keen interest in history, it seems like to have an understanding of any sort of dissent, you have to kind of pursue it. The reliance on structures and systems, dare I say, not only our educational system, but popular culture, at least in the mainstream, don't readily give us a sense of continuity or understanding of dissent. Is that a fair observation? I don't know.
Well, I think that dissenters, when they're going out to, protest against whatever it is, they frequently do have that sense of continuity. They model their protest on others that have gone before. For example, the civil rights movement used a lot of the methods that the women's suffrage movement used during World War I. With the sit-in, picketing at the White House and all this. And then later, the anti-war movement during the Vietnam War used a lot of the techniques that the sit-in, the SNCC did, you know, with the sit-ins and the freedom rides and such. And so there was always this sense of looking at what has worked for other dissent movements. Now, I think today, you know, with the internet and all these other things, there's a lot of confusion that's sown in the world. And, you know, people will sometimes, you know, see something, you know, like a conspiracy theory or some sort of, you know, something that's wrong that's on the internet. And that might kind of try to, inform their views about things. And I think, you know, a lot of people really need to understand exactly how dissent is practiced in this country, and we have to continue to look at dissent movements in order to understand if they express legitimate grievances or act as a smokescreen for those whom are interested in undermining democracy and thwarting its extension. You know, the right to dissent is really central to our democracy, and we must protect that right, but we have to make sure that we are practicing it in accordance with the principles of this Republican, democratic Republican form of government.
And dare I say it, it's not necessarily dissent, that is not necessarily of the left or the right or one particular ideological thrust or the other.
Right. Yeah. And dissent has basically, you know, really been apolitical, because dissenters are pushing, you know, for their rights, and they can come from both the right and the left. But most of the dissent, of course, has been pushing for more progressive ideals for the expansion of rights. But conservative dissent has the benefit of forcing us to kind of slow down and think about how these changes are going to have an impact in the long run and whether they are really good or not. But it also helps people get into a dialogue. So when people are pushing for something and others are pushing back against it, at least it creates a dialogue between people. And so people can wind up influencing each other and convincing each other that the goals of this particular dissent movement are really just and right and fit in with our principles.
And lastly, dissent doesn't always necessarily bring victory. In fact, it's quite costly to many people who practice it.
Oh yeah. There have been quite a few people who have been killed or certainly seriously injured. And
I mentioned Joe Hill earlier.
Sure. Yeah. And one of the things that's interesting, a lot of the dissenters who were vilified and demonized at the time of their dissent are now kind of heroes for us. As time goes by, more and more people recognize the value that they had contributed to the expansion of American democracy.
Can dissenters be both within a setting or an institution or a structure and without? I promised the listeners that we'd start from the Depression and quickly go forward into World War II. And I was thinking about Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Eleanor Roosevelt, two examples. In my mind, maybe it's a misreading of your book, but Roosevelt was sort of a dissenter from the American mainstream of America First, American isolationism. He had to find ways to maneuver and, pardon the expression, to get us into the war.
Yeah, you know, Roosevelt once, he was one of the few politicians in the world, at the time when Britain was appeasing Hitler, Neville Chamberlain and others in the British cabinet. Roosevelt was very concerned that, about Hitler. And he was trying to convince the American people that Hitler was an endangerment to the United States, even though in the late 30s, as Hitler was coming to power and, consolidating his power in Germany, for a lot of Americans, he didn't appear that way. So when he began pushing for things like Lend-Lease and, amending the Neutrality Acts and such, what happened was the America First movement kind of grew up in opposition to Roosevelt. And then Roosevelt tried everything in his power to lead the American people to realize that Hitler was a threat to the United States and American democracy. And he once said that it was a terrible thing to be trying to lead the people and look over his shoulder and see that nobody was following him. So, you know, of course, he was in a position of, you know, not absolute power, but, you know, he had a lot of power in the United States. But of course, we're a democracy, and that power of a president is always, you know, constrained by the legislature and the judiciary. But he did have a vision for a more progressive future for the United States. And he was the first president that really pushed the United States to think that the federal government was something that was there to enact progress, to deal with the problems of the Depression, for example. Now, his wife, Eleanor, was even more of, you know, an outspoken dissenter, because Roosevelt, of course, had to work to compromise with senators and such to get anything through. But
particularly Southern senators.
Especially, and they dominated all of the important committees. And so, like, Roosevelt did think we needed an anti-lynching law, federal anti-lynching law, but he didn't dare push for it because he would lose the support of Southern senators for other programs for the New Deal. But Eleanor had no qualms in pushing for it because she didn't have to deal with compromising with senators. But she was, you know, really one of the important figures that, even though I wouldn't say she necessarily participated in any sort of civil rights movement, but she really pushed for it, becoming good friends with Mary Bethune, with so many other African-American leaders, A. Philip Randolph, she was very good friends with.
Organizing Marian Anderson's concert.
Exactly, Easter Sunday in 1939. And then, you know, going down and visiting the Tuskegee Airmen as they were being trained. Yes. And, you know, it was this great story about how when she was visiting there, one of the, you know, the white and, the officers there were all white, and they were the teachers, the instructors for the cadets. And she asked that, you know, when she arrived at Tuskegee, they said, "Is there anything we can do for you?" And she said to the commandant, "Well, I would like to go up in one of the planes." And he asked one of the white officers to take her up. And she said, "No, I want to go up with him." And she pointed at one of the black cadets. And this is in Alabama, you know. And the white commandant was like all tongue-tied. But she insisted, and she said, "Well, you are training them correctly, right? You know, so it shouldn't be a danger for me to go up." And then there was that great photograph of her sitting in the back seat of one of the cadets' planes, you know, as it was about to take off. And this, of course, enraged so many Southerners, but it really was something that was a very positive thing, just like the Marian Anderson concert was very positive for the African-American community.
So visuals and actions do indeed matter, as you are an appreciator of the arts, and that's peppered throughout your book. So I'll remind listeners that we're talking to Dr. Ralph Young. Professor Young is indeed professor of instruction in history at Temple University. His latest book, American Patriots, A Short History of Dissent, is the basis of our conversation. We're looking at dissent, and we're launching forward to go from about the period of World War II as far as we can get into our present day situation with Dr. Young. Thank you. So, Dr. Young, we've looked kind of from the top down in the bigger picture. And what I appreciate, I think you kind of operate in the tradition of Howard Zinn. It's the everyday people that really matter. And I wonder if you can tell us, coming out of the Depression, but during it, Miles Horton and Jim West established a very important school that's going to supply dissent and social justice for ages to come.
Yes, this was the Highlander Folk School in Tennessee. And during the 30s, when it began, it was initially training, activists in the labor movement and, you know, in various techniques like the sit-down strike and such, and teaching people songs. That's the, you know, folk, you know, aspect of the title, songs to sing on the picket line and such. But, you know, during World War II and afterwards, it started concentrating a lot on the civil rights movement. And a lot of civil rights activists went to Highlander and took workshops and, you know, various sort of, you know, activism techniques. And for example, Rosa Parks, before her famous arrest in Montgomery, was, you know, spent some time at Highlander and doing, and so now she was, there's a lot of mythology that she was just this tired old lady, but she wasn't that tired and she wasn't that old, but she was intentionally doing what she was doing. And this was something that was actually, an act of civil disobedience in a way. So the Highlander, and also one of the really kind of important things about Highlander is that one of the people that would go down there and sometimes be teaching people songs to sing on the picket line was Pete Seeger. And he took, along with Miles Horton and a couple others there, they took this old African-American hymn about I will overcome, basically the trials and the perils of Satan someday. And he changed it to we shall overcome, and, you know, and added different words to it and sped up the beat to it. And they began teaching this to activists, both in the labor movement and in the civil rights movement. And then, and Pete Seeger once in an interview commented how he, you know, he was at Highlander when Martin Luther King was there and taught him that song. And that after Martin Luther King left Highlander, he was saying to one of the people in the car as he was leaving, he was kind of humming the song, and he said, you know, that song really kind of sticks with you, doesn't it? And of course, the rest, as they say, is history, as he, you know, they began adapting it to the civil rights movement in the late 50s.
Right. So a focus on labor and civil rights and probably general conditions of humanity all from that school. I would just like to acknowledge too that Joe Hill song is part of the engine, is the Highlander School keeping that song going. Yes. Florence Reese, Which Side Are You On?
Right.
Is also part of that repertoire.
Yeah. And then, you know, some of Woody Guthrie's songs, you know, like Union Made, you know, I'm Sticking with the Union, and different.
The one you take special note of is a song, Deportee, about the Bracero, the Mexican workers who were exploited and then expelled. And
there was a plane crash in which, back, I think it was around 1940, it happened, and these were migrant workers in the fruit fields in California who were being deported back to Mexico, and the plane crashed, and the radio and newspapers, all the commentary about it was, you know, when they were talking about the crash and the amount of people that were killed, they said at the end of the report, but they were just deportees. And this really angered Woody Guthrie, and he wrote a song about it. And it is a song that, you know, I often will play for my students when we're talking about protest music. And even though it was written back in the 40s, it's still, you know, it could have been written yesterday, you know, and the sentiment that so many people have about the reality of undocumented immigrants.
Well, another lasting song, and it smacks of a lot of boldness, is This Land Is Your Land, which I understand was a rejoinder to God Bless America.
Yes, Woody Guthrie was kind of incensed when he heard, Irving Berlin's God Bless America, because Woody Guthrie's attitude is God bless everybody. And he thought that the song was kind of the epitome of American sanctimoniousness. And so he started writing This Land Is Your Land. And he had, the first draft of it, you know, and I've seen copies of this, instead of saying this land was made for you and me as the last line, it was always, did God bless America for me? And he had also radical verses about seeing people on the relief line, and he wondered as they stood hungry, did God bless America for me? Yet another verse where he says he was strolling, he saw a sign said private property. On the other side, it said nothing. That side was made for you and me. And but then, of course, later he changed it all to this land was made for you and me. And then, and of course, what kids are being taught in kindergarten, they have all the ordinary verses, but not any of the radical verses.
Well, it's well and good that we talk about this wonderful institution, but I also want to emphasize, as we're getting lifted out of the Depression, partly because of the New Deal, but unfortunately partly because we're entering World War II. And it's also important to recognize that all people have agency, particularly people of color. And it was with pleasure to come across the names of Hirabayashi Yasui and Korematsu, and how they had this stand up and they called this country on what it had written and promised. Can you explain about these gentlemen?
Well, these were Japanese Americans who were incarcerated in the internment camps during World War II, starting in 1942. And on all three of them wound up, taking cases all the way to the Supreme Court. And all three, lost, but they were, really, and all three were American citizens. They were born in the United States. They were the second generation of Japanese immigrants that had come into the country. And they, pushed hard against that, and they really were almost naive in a way in believing in the rights of an American citizen, and that they should not be deprived of their liberty just because of their ancestry.
Yeah, they did a lot of Bill of Rights argumentation, did they not?
Yes, in all of the those cases. And it's really interesting. When I was doing my Dissent in America, Voices That Shaped a Nation book, I was in touch with Yatsui's sister and was able to get a couple of copies of letters that he wrote to her while he was incarcerated and fighting this, this executive order. And they're very kind of heartwarming and inspiring in a way.
Well, we're coming up on the halfway point of our show. But in regards to World War II, as far as the population and the rank and file of us, your book notes that between 1941 and 1945, there were about 37,000 pacifists who made conscientious objection declarations. Yeah. 7,000, and some people argue even more, refused to serve in the military at all. Mm-hmm. And if I'm not mistaken, what about 4,000 wound up in prison? I'm not sure about that figure.
I don't know the exact figure offhand right now, but quite a few conscientious objectors were confined to prison, and some of them they actually volunteered to do medical work. Some of them were also what happened with some of them is that they volunteered for these medical experiments where they would be given, for example, malaria, something like this. And so that various kinds of, serums would be used against them and to fight this. And a lot of them got, really quite sick from that. Two of the really, really interesting characters were, one of them, of course, was, the man who eventually, organized the March on Washington. I just want to see if I can find some pictures of these guys just to.
Sure. Our audience can't see, but I'll appreciate it.
Yeah.
Since you're referring to Bayard Rustin.
Yeah, Bayard Rustin and David Dellinger, who actually, they were confined to a prison in eastern Pennsylvania. And they started organizing within the prison. On Saturday nights, they would show films, but there would be a section for the black inmates and a section for the white inmates. And Bayard Rustin would sit with the whites and David Dellinger would sit with the blacks. And they actually wound up desegregating the prison they were in.
I'll tell you what, let's find out more about these two figures, but the clock is upon us and we do have to take a break to provide public service announcements. We're talking to Ralph Young about American Descent. You're listening to We the People right here at WPFW, and stick with us. We'll be right back shortly.
Hi, this is Miyuki Williams, recently appointed interim general manager. I want to thank each and every one of you who supported WPFW during our recent relocation drive. You are the fuel that keeps us going. We appreciate your generosity and the collaboration of building a better world, one broadcast at a time. Please know we all love you madly.
Thank you.
The search process for WPFW's next general manager is underway. Successful management searches begin by having conversations with stakeholders to clarify and document expectations for future management. Therefore, WPFW's local station board is inviting all stakeholders to participate in our online survey. To complete the survey, please click the link on WPFW's website. Because we need your input, the deadline for the survey has been extended to Friday, April 12, 2024. Thank you.
And welcome back to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, right here at WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. Your Pacifica radio station that brought you and is bringing you jazz and justice for over 47 years, because people like you, the listener, choose to support us financially in our entirety. For that, I'm grateful. I join 80 other programmers in thanking you. And please, please do tell a friend about this show or other shows that you do listen to on WPFW. Our guest is Dr. Ralph Young. He is he's professor of instruction in history at Temple University. And his latest book, American Patriots, A Short History of Dissent, is the basis of our discussion. We've been talking about dissent, its nature, its particular impulses, or the people who represent dissent from World War II onward. And before our break, Dr. Young, again, thank you for being with us. We mentioned two very interesting men, Bayard Rustin and David Dellinger. And they will not only do their activism during the war, but they really give us a rich legacy and guidance going forward. Again, tell us a little bit about them.
Yes, Bayard Rustin, of course, as most of our listeners will know, and of course, I hope everybody has seen that film that came out recently about him that was really quite well done. He wound up becoming a really significant figure in the civil rights movement, and immediately when Martin Luther King was involved with the Montgomery bus boycott, Bayard Rustin went down to Montgomery and met with King, and it was Bayard Rustin who really pushed King even harder in the direction of nonviolent dissent. And he also, and of course he was very controversial because he was gay and he was, had been a communist. And the FBI was, you know, trying to find out all sorts of dirt about him and trying to link, you know, the civil rights movement to the international communist conspiracy and such. And so in some ways he had to play a low profile in it, but he was really the chief organizer of the March on Washington, which most dissenters don't realize that when you do something like that, you have to, it's not just a question of going out and protesting, you have to organize food and toilets and, you know, all
buses,
everything. And so it's a major, major dedicated work that you have to do. And of course, you know, he was, you know, very important in the civil rights movement all through it until his death, really. David Dullinger, after his bout in prison during World War II for not conscientious objection, became one of the leading figures in the demonstration, you know, against the war in Vietnam. And he was one of the Chicago Seven who was tried after the Chicago Convention, where the police rioted and beaten up so many people. And so David Dullinger, who had, you know, both Dullinger and Rustin were Quakers, and so therefore they had this pacifist views, and both men became really very important in the 1960s movements.
So we're somehow finding ourselves in the 50s, about to go into the 60s, mm-hmm. but there was a phrase or something that leaped out in the chapter regarding the 50s about, in one regard, people in the United States, maybe elsewhere, but more so in this country, thought Armageddon was around the corner, so to speak. The, dare I say, advent of nuclear power, but the unfortunate development of it into weaponry was very clear in the minds, as even the movie Oppenheimer reminds right. us of. So there's a sense of strength and power and security. Mm-hmm. But as you put it, there's kind of a schism between having a sense of confidence and having a sense of paranoia. Could yeah. you explain more, please?
Well, you know, after World War II, Americans felt very good about themselves. We had defeated Hitler. We won the war. We made the war safe against fascism. And, you know, of course, not even thinking that, you know, how many millions of people the Russians lost in the fight against Hitler and such. But we felt that, and also the American economy did not go back into a slump after the war, which usually after a war, the economy, you know, as soldiers getting discharged and they're looking for jobs and there are less jobs, there's always, you know, economic issues. But after the war, because of the atomic bomb and all the research going into atomic weaponry and so many other things that were combined, the American economy boomed during the 1950s. And so many Americans were feeling, you know, we're great, you know, we saved the world for democracy, you know, we have this wonderful economy, and everybody in the world should be like us, they should adopt the American way. And as decolonization was happening in Africa, and so many African countries are getting independence, we were sending people over there to convince them to set up an American type of government. Russians were sending people there to convince them to set up a socialist type of government. And this becomes an important factor, actually, in strengthening the civil rights movement, because we could say to these countries in Africa, don't be like the Soviet Union because they don't respect human rights. And the Soviet Union is telling these, you know, people, governments, don't be like Americans. Look what they do to your brothers and sisters in the South and such. And so it forced the American government to do something about this huge contradiction within American society.
Would that be, in some regards, kind of sub rosa, below the surface, among elites, whereas you have a society that's defining family, race, religion, where people live? I mean, this is the time of, you know, Leave It to Beaver and Father Knows Best, and
right, right.
The Adventures of Superman, which ends with truth, justice, and the American way in its theme. So you have this canopy that yeah. everything's all right. So I guess that's the confidence part, is it not?
Yes. And then, of course, you know, we're having to do these duck and cover drills in school. Yeah. And there was always this sense that, you know, there was always this sense in the 50s that everything is great, but it might all end at any moment.
It might go up in a puff of smoke. Exactly. I couldn't help myself. Sorry, sir.
So. Like Tom Lehrer did, you know, he did a lot of funny songs about the, we're all going to go together when we go, for example. Like, we don't have to worry about grieving and going to funerals anymore because we're all going to be fried yeah. at the same time.
You know, it's, you mentioned the the arts as far as this musician, but when people see something like The Day the Earth Stood Still, you know, that, and there's plenty of art and public expression talking about these contradictions, even though I named mainstream sources, there are things that we can take notice. And someone realized the power of art and performance. Let's start the period noting that Paul Robeson met with a violent riot in Peekskill, New York, upstate New York, yep, in 1949. And Pete Seeger was called in to testify in front of the House of Americans Activities Committee. And there's an important man that's an example that stood out. You spent a little bit of time talking about him or writing about him in your book, John Howard Lawson, the screenwriter. Right. And why is he an important example of the dynamics that are going on here in the struggle?
He was one of the Hollywood 10, and you know, the House Committee on American Activities was trying to cover all forms of communist subversion in the United States, and they realized that Hollywood had a huge influence on American attitudes. Like a film, for example, like Grapes of Wrath, basically it's just about the reality of what's going on in the Depression, but the way a lot of people looked at it is that anything that kind of elevated the poor was basically socialism in disguise and such. And so John Howard Lawson, who is like a producer and a screenwriter, was brought before the House Committee on American Activities. And he tried to give a statement, claiming that he's 100% American. He believes in this Bill of Rights, and that just the fact that he's being called in front of this committee is an infringement on his right of free speech and such. But the House Committee wouldn't even allow him to read that statement into the record. And so he was blacklisted, as were so many others. Paul Robeson, Pete Seeger, both were dragged before the committee. Paul Robeson tried to give the committee a lesson in African-American history and explaining that, he mentioned good things about Russia after the State Department sent him to Russia during World War II.
Yes, hypocrisy, yeah.
And he noticed he didn't experience Jim Crow in Moscow. And so he was saying good things about that. And of course, that got him into trouble. Pete Seeger was, he had been writing anti-war songs, like Where Have All the Flowers Gone, for example. And at that time, if you were anti-war, the jump made by a lot of people was that you were pro-Russian because you're not willing to fight against the Russians.
Or even a communist infiltrator, yes.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, and Pete Seeger was blacklisted. But what was interesting about Pete Seeger, unlike so many of the others, most refused to answer questions on the grounds of the Fifth Amendment. Pete Seeger refused to answer the questions on the grounds of the First Amendment. He basically said, you have no right to ask me that question. It's like you walking into the voting booth with me and looking over my shoulder and seeing who I vote for. Well, he was, convicted of contempt of Congress for that and blacklisted for 17 years.
Well, even within the Senate, though, they had a champion of sorts, Margaret Chase Smith. Can you tell us about her?
She was quite wonderful. She was the first woman senator, and she was a Republican from Maine. And she, like all Republicans in 1952, when Eisenhower was running against Stevenson, she was longing for a Republican victory. You know, after a total of 20 years of Roosevelt and then Truman, Republicans were chomping at the bit to take back the White House. But and then people like McCarthy were using the anti-communist, weapon, to for political advantage. And she took him on. She challenged McCarthy that he was, this was smear and and basically he was more of a threat to American democracy than the Russians were. And she issued this declaration of conscience in which she says, let me quote from this, a Republican regime embracing a philosophy that lacks political integrity or intellectual honesty would prove disastrous to this nation. I don't want to see the Republican Party ride to political victory on the four horsemen of calumny, fear, ignorance, bigotry, and smear. I don't believe the American people will uphold any political party that puts political exploitation above national interest.
And of course, that's being presently put to the test.
Yes, and this was 1952. That's what, 70 years ago. And it's something that I think a lot of people should, pay attention to right now.
And part of the duty of media and certain educational sources would be to at least convey that as
absolutely
objectively as possible throughout time. Well, speaking of time, maybe I can pick up the pace with my questions a little bit better here. We find ourselves in the 50s going into the 60s, and people now think there's a big unraveling. It's kind of a countercultural revolution. And the Beats, that motley collection of writers, comes into the arena, so to speak.
Yeah, you have, Allen Ginsberg, Jack Kerouac, and the others that even though the Beat movement was a small minority of people, they did have a big influence. And what they did in their literature was emphasize all of the marginalized people, whether it was African Americans or American Indians or ex-cons or drug dealers or, so many different groups of people that were not seen on Leave It to Beaver and Father Knows Best and Ozzie and Harriet, these other shows that were on television. And so whether it's in the Allen Ginsberg's poems like Howl and America and others, or Jack Kerouac's On the Road, they're emphasizing the downtrodden, the beaten down. Thus they get the name The Beats. Kerouac in an interview once said that basically they call themselves The Beats because of three reasons. One, they were, they were talking about the downtrodden, they were elevating them. They also had the beat. They were into bebop. They were into Charlie Parker and stuff. And then thirdly, there was a spiritual element in the Beatitudes from the Bible. Blessed are the meek, blessed are the poor. The press, of course, dubbed them beatniks. This was after Sputnik was launched. And by calling them beatniks, it's sort of challenging their veracity and basically kind of equating them with the Soviet Union. Just like, anti-war people during the Vietnam War were called peaceniks.
Yeah.
You throw a nick on the end of the word and it questions somebody's Americanism or patriotism. Yeah.
So moving right along, I guess, there's an energy or synergy that goes along with the peace movement at this time. Mm-hmm. And this is what I was remiss about in our first show. I wanted to make sure to get to this. If you could tell us a little bit about the SDS, what mm-hmm. it stood for. And
Students for the Democratic Society. They were, part of the New Left. And of course, that implies that there was an old left, and the old left, yes, was the 1930s, typical Marxist-Leninist organization about, fighting against those who own the means of production. But with the new left, they also added an element of conscience, that we need to work on our own consciousness and our conscientious ideas about things. And it's not just about changing who runs things or changing laws. It's about changing your attitudes about things. At first, when they got started at the University of Michigan back in 1960, they were working with workers in the unions in Detroit, the auto workers, and trying to radicalize them, get them more radical. But as the civil rights movement began, and with 1960, you had the sit-ins, 1961, the freedom rides. A lot of SDSers sort of joining and participating in the civil rights movement. And Some of them were involved in the Freedom Ride. Some of them were involved in the Freedom Summer in 1964. In 1962, they issued the Port Huron Statement, which basically calls for a participatory democracy in which everybody gets involved in local politics and starting to try to change things. Later, when the Vietnam War started really getting into gear, they became one of the major organizers of a lot of anti-war demonstrations.
Sit-ins, draft card burnings.
Yes.
Other forms of protest, yes.
And of course, they were really very much, it was very intellectual because they used, the writings of Herbert Marcuse, Frantz Fanon, so many of the leading Marxist, intellectuals. In their critique of American capitalism, what they looked at Vietnam as an example of American imperialism, a bit different from the way Quakers like David Dullinger looked at Vietnam. It was more of a moral issue with them.
I think it's fair to say that this group would understand the summing up or practice of war to be a liberal enterprise and not so much a categorical polar extreme, but that it's very much representative of, I don't want to say everyday people, but people who have different roles that are normalized.
Yeah. Well, they were very critical of liberals. They were extremely disappointed that liberals would be in power under like Kennedy and then Johnson, and that the war in Vietnam would escalate. And also they felt that liberals weren't doing enough speedily enough for the civil rights movement. And I think one of the things that helped give rise to the counterculture was that so many people after, about 10 years or so of a really significant civil rights movement, and then with war in Vietnam coming in on the heels of this, a lot of young Americans were getting very impatient that the liberal politicians were not doing enough about these things. And then they started questioning all of American values, not just about race and about war, but also materialism, consumerism, middle-class values, attitudes about sexuality and gender relationships. All of this started getting criticized and reevaluated by this young generation.
And again, you've talked about with dissent, it's met with counter dissent. And so those things become morphed into a commentary that talks about a social or cultural unraveling. I just want to quickly, I know we just have about 3 to 4 minutes left, say again, one of the merits of your book is you acknowledge the importance of the arts and public expression. Mm-hmm. And not only do we have Bob Dylan through many different songs saying you must be personally aware and personally involved, he does that talking about the death of The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll. Right. Only a Pawn in Their Game is about the assassination of Medgar Evers. Blowing in the Wind is another obvious example. Yeah. But you have, Phil Ox, who's an interesting figure, by the way, and Tom Paxton, Joan Baez, even Paul Simon. But I want to also say, importantly for Washingtonians, Marvin Gaye does a whole album about a returning Vietnam veteran. And he talks about environmentalism.
Yes.
So you have all that there.
Yeah. There were so many people that were getting involved in, in writing protest music. For example, Marvin Gaye and Sam Cooke, some were, influenced by Dylan's Blown in the Wind. If some white guy can write something like this, I can certainly write songs, dealing with race and all of these issues. Nina Simone was another really significant one with Mississippi Goddamn that she wrote after the killing of those four girls at the 16th Street Baptist Church. It's kind of an interesting thing how folk music became, because folk songs tell a story, they can also tell a political story. And there were so many things that were influenced by this with in kind of mainstream American pop music and rock and roll eventually with, African-American music, whether it was soul or gospel or what was, Motown. A lot of people were just getting involved in writing songs that were dealing with political and social issues of the day. And this helped, I also say that it was like the social media of the time. It was where an alternative message was being presented to the public.
So speaking of which, we're going to just take a big leap. And I knew we were going to run out of time. Mm-hmm. There's a way that dissent gets co-opted in popular culture through different sources. What is the thing we must hold on to in respecting the notion of dissent? And that's my final question for you.
To go back to the Constitutional Convention and such, and what is so important, I think, is, an educated public. We need to have people become aware of the true nature of our history. Jefferson, who wrote, these rights are inalienable. He also wrote, and I was just reading this in this book by Annette Gordon Reed and Peter Onuf. They quote Jefferson in his Notes of Virginia that it was not enough to believe the principles of the new experiment of self-government in the United States. The success of the revolution and the Republican experiment depended on the continuing strength of character of the people. Citizens must be educated and well-informed so that they'd be able to recognize demagogues and would-be tyrants who would beguile and manipulate them. This is from Jefferson back in the 18th century.
And it's rare that Mr. Jefferson has the last word here, but let me thank you, Ralph Young. Dr. Ralph Young, professor in instruction at Temple University. And the book is American Dissent, A Short History.
From WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. The first seven jurors have been selected in Donald Trump's hush money criminal trial. Jury selection is expected to continue tomorrow. 11 more people, 5 jurors and 6 alternates, still need to be picked in the case. Dozens have already been dismissed because they said they couldn't be impartial. Judge Juan Merchan admonished the former president yesterday for intimidating jurors after Trump was heard muttering something under his breath during jury selection. Trump is charged with 34 felony counts of falsifying business records to hide $130,000 paid to Stormy Daniels ahead of the 2016 election. Opening arguments could begin as soon as Monday. In another courtroom in Virginia, an Army general who investigated the abuse of prisoners 20 years ago at Iraq's infamous Abu Ghraib prison testified yesterday that a civilian contractor instructed prison guards to, quote, soften up detainees for interrogations. The testimony provided by retired General Antonio Taguba was the strongest evidence yet that civilian employees of the Virginia-based military contractor, CACI, played a role in the abuse of Abu Ghraib inmates. In a trial that began Monday, 3 former inmates at the prison are suing CACI, alleging that the company contributed to the torturous treatment they suffered. The trial, delayed by more than 15 years of legal wrangling, is the first time that Abu Ghraib inmates have been able to bring a civil case in front of a U.S. jury. On Capitol Hill, the Senate will begin the impeachment trial of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas today with the swearing in of jurors. Meanwhile, Senate Democrats could move as swiftly as today to dismiss or table the articles on a simple majority vote. House Republicans sent 2 articles of impeachment to the Senate yesterday, accusing Mayorkas of allegedly failing to enforce immigration laws
and of lying to Congress by saying the border was secure. Democrats have dismissed the matter as a politicized misuse of the impeachment process and claim that policy disagreements are not a justification for the rarely used constitutional impeachment of a cabinet official. Mayorkas is only the second cabinet secretary to be impeached in U.S. history. And global progress in making childbirth safer for women has basically stalled